Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. One of the most discussed breast cancer papers at the 2006 ASCO meeting was a study by Dr. Sharon Giordano utilizing the SEER Medicare database to evaluate long-term cardiac problems in patients receiving anthracyclines. I met with Dr. Giordano to reconsider these groundbreaking findings in light of a year of clinical research that has left many reconsidering the future of adjuvant anthracyclines. Dr. Giordano began by commenting on the background to her study.
One of the things that's always intrigued me is the lack of information about long-term toxicity of chemotherapy and generally of all the therapies that we give our patients. And I initially got interested in long-term toxicities of radiation therapy, and it made me really think that we know very little about chemotherapy and the long-term treatment. Most of the work I do has been with national databases like the SEER database. And so what we did was we looked at the SEER Medicare database, which is a big national database of people 65 and older with cancer, looked how people were treated in the adjuvant setting, and then compared patients for their rates of heart failure down the road. Although the people who received anthracyclines tended to be younger, tended to be healthier, but despite that, when we looked at 5 and 10 years down the road, they had higher rates of heart failure than patients who got other kinds of chemotherapy like CMF.
Could you talk a little bit about the specific numbers that came out of that study? Because I think that's what really caught everybody's attention in terms of how high they were, even the baseline numbers.
Yeah, I mean, the rates of heart failure we saw were very high. And we did see very high rates of congestive heart failure, even in patients who were not treated with chemotherapy or not treated with anthracyclines.
But this is clinical heart failure, treatment for heart failure, correct?
Correct.
Based on Medicare coding, I mean, you were seeing like 30-40%
right.
risk.
Right. It's based on Medicare coding, and I think that's an important caveat to remember. So we don't have echo results. We don't have physician examinations. We have billing codes from Medicare to indicate heart failure. There have been validity studies showing it is a valid way to pick up heart failure and that it is accurate, but I put less weight on the absolute numbers from our study than I do on the comparison, because I wouldn't really think it would be coded differently for somebody who received anthracyclines 10 years ago than somebody who received CMF 10 years ago.
So at the end of the day, so to speak, how much of an additional risk do you think was presented by having anthracyclines?
Well, somewhere in the range of an increase of 5 to 10% risk by receiving adjuvant anthracyclines, which is substantial.
And if you ask most oncologists, as we've done in surveys, what do you tell your patients, that most people say 1%.
Right.
So where's the disparity?
I would think 1% is really numbers based on clinical trials looking at short-term toxicity of anthracyclines. And our numbers are really based looking 5 and 10 years down the road for patients treated.
I mean, is that what you're saying to your patients now, that by using an anthracycline regimen, you know, 4 cycles of AC or something like that, you're creating an excess risk of 5 or 10% of heart failure in the long run?
Since it's not data from a randomized controlled trial, I don't think I can say it with that degree of certainty. But I am telling them that there may be long-term consequences of heart failure, and we really don't have an accurate way at this point of estimating what that risk is, but it may be higher than just the short-term risk of heart failure.
The other thing, and you've also done work on this, is the issue of leukemia. Can you talk mm-hmm. about what we know about that and also that from the long-term perspective and the baseline age perspective?
Right. One of the other long-term consequences of chemotherapy is increased risk of leukemia. So we did a similar study, again, looking at the SEER Medicare database for the rates of leukemia in older women who are breast cancer survivors. In contrast to the very high rates of heart failure, actually found very low rates of leukemia. And there was about 0.5% increase in risk of leukemia for older women who got chemotherapy. So that actually was pretty, I think, reassuring data that while that risk is out there and it's real, that it wasn't vastly amplified, even in this older population of patients.
What about non-anthracycline adjuvant regimens? And a lot of people now have been talking about the TC, docetaxel cyclophosphamide regimen that Steve Jones reported and then published from U.S. Oncology. What are your thoughts about that regimen and just in general the possibility of excluding or not using anthracyclines?
Well, I think it's a very promising regimen, and I think that if the results of our study are validated in prospective studies, that having an option for non-anthracycline chemotherapy is wonderful. I don't think at this point that it's replaced anthracyclines, but I think it is another option. It's equally effective. And for patients that I perceive are at higher risk for developing heart failure or have other risk factors, it's something I would go to more readily now with my concern about long-term toxicities.
And that was another really stunning, you know, I remember that slide when you put it up last year, looking at things like hypertension and other factors that might increase the risk. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what you looked at and what you saw there?
Right. We saw factors that you would expect would increase risk of heart failure did. So things like hypertension, patients with increasing age, patients with diabetes, and patients with pre-existing heart disease, all of those did increase the risk of subsequent heart failure.
I mean, that was a pretty substantial increase, too.
Yeah.
It seemed like it was about 50% more.
Yes.
So again, a patient has totally well-controlled hypertension or diabetes or both, but that is going to be a little bit of a red flag to you?
Yes. I mean, I think that does increase the risk of developing heart failure. We did look to see if there was an interaction, so see if this was a particular risk for patients treated with anthracyclines, and none of those seemed to really target the patients who are at risk for anthracycline heart failure. So while they predispose patients in general to get heart failure, I'm not sure that those would prevent me from using anthracyclines in a patient.
In a non-protocol situation, what tends to be the chemotherapy regimen or regimens that you usually consider in the lower risk patient, node negative, for example?
We typically at Anderson will use FAC, six cycles of FAC for our low risk patients. And then for the higher risk node positive, use weekly paclitaxel times 12 followed by FAC times 4.
What's your take on all the controversy that's occurred about the issue of adjuvant chemotherapy in patients with ER positive tumors, and how do you bring that into your own decision making?
I think there's increasing data that patients with ER-positive tumors benefit less from chemotherapy than patients with ER-negative tumors, but I'm not convinced at this point that there is no benefit from chemotherapy. I think studies like TAILOR-X, where we're trying to look at patients who are ER-positive and stratified by risk, might help answer, is there a subset of patients that you could select out that wouldn't eventually need chemotherapy? And for patients that are borderline candidates for chemotherapy, if they have ER-positive disease, I'm less inclined to give them chemotherapy. But for patients who have high-risk disease, even if it's ER-positive, I think these patients still clearly benefit.
Now, you mentioned TAILOR-X and brings up the issue of Oncotype and how that ties into management of patients with ER-positive tumors, specifically with node-negative tumors. Are you putting patients on the TAILOR-X trial, and how, if at all, do you utilize Oncotype in a non-protocol situation?
We do participate in the TAILOR-X trial, so we have been putting patients on that trial. And this trial runs the Oncotype for the patient, and if they're intermediate risk, then randomizes them to either chemotherapy or no chemotherapy. If they're low risk, then you would go ahead and just use a hormonal treatment. If they're high risk, you would go ahead and use chemotherapy. Off-protocol, I've used it in patients, again, who are really borderline candidates for chemotherapy, either because of comorbidities that they have or not wanting chemotherapy or just having fairly low-risk tumors, to try to help both me and the patient make a decision as to whether or not they have chemotherapy.
I guess the other issue is whether or not you could uncover patients who otherwise might appear to have low risk, who have high recurrence scores. Is that a scenario that you've run into also?
Again, I usually haven't run it except in borderline patients. So patients that really look very low risk, very small tumors, I tend personally not to order Oncotype on those. But patients that are right around a centimeter in size, low to intermediate grade, ER positive, node negative, those are the patients that I think it can be very helpful.
Is there a tumor size where you kind of like pull away from that issue? You can maybe get uncomfortable just relying on the Oncotype, tumors 2, 3, or 3.5 centimeters?
Yeah, I can't say that there's a clear cutoff, but really for things that are over 2 centimeters in size, again, I'm inclined to give chemotherapy to those patients and typically personally don't order it in that situation.
What about the issue of trastuzumab in the heart? There was a oral presentation on the adjuvant studies. Can you talk a little bit about where we are right now in terms of that issue?
Clearly, trastuzumab increases the risk of cardiac toxicity. Doing it concurrently with chemotherapy seems to be a higher risk than doing it sequentially with chemotherapy, but then you're balancing that against perhaps it being more effective as a treatment given concurrently rather than sequentially. It's always an issue that comes up, again, even more so for, I think, low-risk patients who we're treating for breast cancer. Again, for those patients, similar to using the TC regimen for high-risk patients that are HER2-negative, I'll often use TCH for the high-risk patients that are HER2-positive.
What was your take on the BCRG data on TCH that's been presented twice now? You said that you are, in some situations, using that in a non-protocol setting. What specific situations? What do you think about that data set?
Well, it's certainly looking stronger and stronger that TCH is an equivalent regimen to the anthracycline-based regimens. So if I have a patient that's older, or again, a patient with pre-existing heart disease, that I'm really worried about heart toxicity, I would go first to TCH.
What about just hypertension or diabetes?
Those might weigh into my decision, but either one of them by themselves wouldn't sway me one way or the other.
And I guess there's some people who say, well, why not just use TCH, period? And we are starting to see people do that, mm-hmm. but it seems like people aren't quite ready to jump on there.
Yeah, I think also patients with a borderline ejection fraction, so maybe clinically look very well, maybe don't even have any cardiac risk factors, but come in with a baseline ejection fraction of 50% or 55%, you still want to give them chemotherapy. Those patients, I think, also are great candidates for TCH.
What about lapatinib in the heart? What do we know about that at this point?
At this point, it appears to be quite safe for the heart. Edith Perez did an overview looking at all the patients that have been enrolled on trials of lapatinib, looking at several thousand patients, some for breast cancer, some not for breast cancer, and found a very low rate of heart toxicity, maybe around 1%. So at least the information we have right now, we're not seeing increased heart toxicity with lapatinib.
What about pertuzumab? What exactly is it, and what do we know about it, particularly in terms of the heart?
So this is a new, I guess, second-generation monoclonal antibody targeting the HER2 receptor. And so this particular antibody prevents dimerization of either HER2 with HER2 or HER2 with HER1 or HER2 with HER3, and so blocks HER2 signaling. So this is a drug that's being developed right now as hopefully a newer or better trastuzumab. And so far also with that drug, I don't think there's been much signal to suggest that there's a lot of heart toxicity, but we really don't have the numbers yet to know that for sure.
Do we know anything about combining it with trastuzumab or lapatinib, or, you know, sort of theoretically what would make sense?
There was a very small study that was an abstract presented at ASCO this year that combined pertuzumab with trastuzumab, and they did not find any unexpected cardiac toxicity. But again, the numbers are still really small, so I don't think we have that data yet.
I know that one of your other interests is in male breast cancer. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about some of the research that's been done in the last few years on that entity and some of the work that you've done in male breast cancer?
Sure. I think some of the big things that have happened in the last few years with male breast cancer have been using population-based data sources to look at it. Because really, before 2 or 3 years ago, almost all the information about male breast cancer came from single-institution retrospective series. And so I did, and I think some other people since then also, have looked using the SEER database and at big national databases of male breast cancer and been able to collect, you know, several thousand patients to look at. Some of the things that we've found that I think are interesting include, one, that the incidence is going up for men with breast cancer. We found that from the 70s until now, there's almost a 25% increase in the incidence of breast cancer in men. We also found that men tend to present with more advanced disease. And I guess this isn't really surprising, given that men aren't having screening mammograms. And I think there's also a delay in diagnosis because of lack of awareness. But men were more likely to present with node-positive disease, more likely to present with advanced disease, and because of that, tended to have poorer outcomes. But when we look age for age and stage for stage, the outcomes are same between men and women with breast cancer.
What about sentinel node in men?
There have been a few series looking at that, probably 5 or 6 different retrospective series now, and so far it seems to have an equivalent sensitivity and specificity. So I know our surgeons at MD Anderson will offer sentinel node biopsy if a patient is clinically node negative.
What about adjuvant therapy, and particularly adjuvant endocrine therapy? What do we know about that in men?
Oh, not enough. It's a very interesting topic. My standard remains tamoxifen. Most men are either estrogen or progesterone receptor positive, over 90% or hormone receptor positive. So when I'm picking adjuvant hormonal therapies, I almost exclusively use tamoxifen. And I pick that really because we have very strong data in the metastatic setting that it does work in male patients. And we have retrospective series showing survival benefit for men treated with tamoxifen. So none of it is the level of a randomized trial, but at least there is solid data. Where the controversy comes in is the use of aromatase inhibitors and whether or not aromatase inhibitors are going to be more effective than tamoxifen, equal or less effective. And you can make arguments really either way for how effective that might be. most of the estrogen in men does come from peripheral aromatization. So it makes sense that if you could shut that down with aromatase inhibitors, it may be a very effective treatment. But there have been some preclinical studies for men, healthy men, using aromatase inhibitors. So when, for example, Arimidex was being first developed by the pharmaceutical industry, it was tested in healthy male volunteers. And in those patients, they had a fall in estrogen levels, although not as complete a fall as in women. But probably because of feedback loops, they also had a doubling in testosterone levels. It's a long-winded answer, but I think the bottom line is that there's a couple case reports with responses. We have a case series of 5 patients where a few had stable disease, but there were no responses. And there's so little data on the efficacy that I'm pretty reluctant to use that in the adjuvant setting.
What about LHRH agonists?
I think those are likely to be quite effective. I mean, I've had patients that have responded very nicely to that in the metastatic setting, and I've actually had some really good responses for the combination of LHRH agonists and aromatase inhibitors.
Really? That's interesting.
Which makes sense, because you're kind of shutting back the negative feedback loop as well as shutting off the aromatase.
Has that actually been reported in the literature?
I have a case report. So there's a letter to the editor in JCO that we reported 2 cases. And one of them was really interesting because he had actually failed a GnRH analog as a single agent and failed an AI as a single agent, but responded to the combination.
Wow. Yeah. Amazing. That's really
very interesting.
It makes sense, though. Mm-hmm. It makes perfect sense. What about LHRH agonist plus tamoxifen in men?
I don't think there's any data on that. I haven't seen anything published.
Fulvestrant?
Again, I have had several physicians in the community who've treated patients, male patients with fulvestrant, and told me they've seen responses.
Yeah, we had one also at one of our case sessions. We told the guy to go ahead and write it up maybe, you know?
Yeah, I wish he would.
I know you've also looked into the issue, the psychosocial issues of male breast cancer. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, in collaboration with some of our behavioral scientists at MD Anderson, there was a study looking at the psychosocial aspects of breast cancer in men. And they did find a real lack of support for men with breast cancer. And some of our research and actually other research in the UK indicated one of the biggest needs is just informational needs. There was less of a call for emotional support, but more of a need for information. And a lot of the male patients were extremely frustrated at the lack of information available to them and the lack of ability to find any information about their disease.
Hmm. So that was a major stressor for them,
mm-hmm.
is the fact that they couldn't. Oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. And I've had patients tell me if they have to hear one more time that, well, if you were a woman, this is what I would do. They find that very frustrating.
Yeah, that makes sense. What about adjuvant chemotherapy in male breast cancer? Again, just trying to follow the female model, or do we have any data?
There's very, very little data. There's one prospective study out of the NCI that treated about 30 patients with stage 2 node-positive male breast cancer with CMF and then compared the outcomes to historical controls. And this did show a better survival than expected from historical controls. We've gone back retrospectively and looked at the MD Anderson experience. It seems like survival's a little better, but there's no data to guide it, so I think it's very reasonable to expect that chemotherapy would be the same between male and female patients, and I use the same regimens.
Roughly how many men get breast cancer in the United States?
It's about 1%.
So a couple thousand, 1,800 cases. I mean, that's not inconsequential number of people. I mean, mm-hmm. what about HER2 positivity? What fraction occur in men, and do you use adjuvant trastuzumab?
It's very uncommon. The initial reports actually looked like the rates were going to be similar when they looked at immunohistochemistry staining, but on further analysis, it was probably older techniques that were being used. And when it's gone back and looked by doing FISH on male patients, there's very few. Like I saw one study was 1 of 58 patients. I think I have a cohort. I've probably seen about 70 or 80 male patients now that I follow, and I think I have one that's FISH amplified and one that's positive by IHC. So just anecdotally, I think it's very low rates of HER2 positivity.
Are there case reports of response in the metastatic setting to Herceptin?
I believe there have been, yeah.
Interesting. Anything else about male breast cancer we haven't talked about? I know there's a lot of interest in oncologists about it. It's so hard to get information on it.
Well, one of the things I've just noticed, again, seeing a lot of patients, is the very high rate of radiation exposure in my male patients with breast cancer. And my sense is that that's a very under-recognized risk factor for male breast cancer.
That's interesting. What kinds of exposure?
All different kinds. I had one patient who had thymic radiation as an infant because he had an enlarged thymus gland. I had one that had tonsillar radiation as a teenager. I have one patient who had chest wall radiation for acne. I have one patient who had total body irradiation as part of a conditioning regimen for a transplant for a prior leukemia. I have a patient whose parents owned a shoe store with the Buster Brown shoe machine where you'd stick your foot and play. And so he and his brothers used to play in that machine all day long, taking x-rays of themselves.
Wow.
Pilots. I have several pilots, and you get radiation exposure each time you fly. So it's all anecdote. But
radiation exposure each time you fly? And how does that happen?
Because of the altitude, you get the equivalent of a chest x-ray every time you fly.
Really?
Yeah. So for men who are pilots or flight attendants and fly a lot, there is an excess of radiation exposure.
Fascinating. You've also been interested, and you mentioned earlier about the issue of radiation therapy in breast cancer and consequences of that. Can you kind of summarize what your thoughts are about that and what we know about it?
Sure. Well, I was interested initially in looking at whether or not the improvements in techniques in radiation therapy have translated into changes in survival over time. When I did my training at MD Anderson, everybody always told me, well, we know that radiation causes heart attacks and heart disease, but that was based on data from a long time ago, and it's probably not an issue anymore. But I couldn't really find any data backing that up. So we went and looked at the SEER database and compared women with left-sided and right-sided breast cancer over time and found that the risk that had been there for patients treated in the 70s really had diminished and maybe gone away. We don't have long enough follow-up on the more recently treated patients to know if there will still be some risk, but it definitely seems to have gone down over time.
Any other areas of research or interest that you have right now that we might want to chat about?
There's a presentation that Dr. Daywood is making, a study that we did together that I think to me is rather interesting. I did a study previously at MD Anderson looking at survival for patients with recurrent breast cancer and showing modest improvements over time. And so we decided to look nationally at this, to look at a big national cohort to see if it was the same, whether survival was improving. So we looked at 15,000 women with metastatic breast cancer at diagnosis through SEER registry. And we did find, as we expected, that there was modest improvements in survival over time. But what was concerning when we looked at it is all the survival benefit was in non-Hispanic white women. So the survival rates for each time cohort got better for white women, but for black women remained completely stagnant. So the median survival stayed at 17 months for black women from like the late 1980s till now, whereas for white women it increased from like 20 to 25 months.
What do you think the explanation is?
I don't know. I mean, we couldn't look at any of the possible causal factors in the database that we had. I mean, we thought that hypothesizing it could be related in differences to access to care, could be lead time bias, rates of insurance, differences in treatment. There are a lot of possibilities.
I wonder, too, about biology. I mean, there's been the issue of, for example, more triple negatives in African-American women. What do we know nationally about the types of tumors that these women get?
Right. So African-American women do tend to present with more aggressive cancers and more of the basal type cancers. So it's possible, too, that over time, if there are fewer black women with HER2-positive disease or with ER-positive disease, then they can't really benefit from the new therapies like trastuzumab or aromatase inhibitors that we have. So that also could make shifts over time.
It's interesting, though, that even in the white women, you're looking at a median of, what, 25 months, you said?
Yeah.
You know, we talk about breast cancer in the metastatic setting as being, quote, a chronic disease, but, you know, dying in 25 months doesn't sound much like a chronic disease.
No, it doesn't, does it?
What about the splay that you see? Is it peaked at, for example, 25 months, or do you see substantial numbers of patients in both directions the other way? People always cite these patients that live for 5 or 10 years with metastatic disease. How often does it really happen?
The 5-year survival rate is still about 20%. So there definitely is a big splay. I mean, there's people who have really aggressive disease that we all know from seeing this in clinic who die fast, and there's people who live for long periods of time.
So I'm just kind of curious. Obviously, there are a lot of specific variables that would go into this, but let's just say you're looking at a patient who's ER/PR positive, doesn't have super aggressive disease, bone only, for example, metastatic disease, who says, statistically, what's the chance they're going to be alive in 2, 5, or 10 years? Not that there are that many people who want to ask that kind of a question, but I'm curious if somebody asked you that, how you'd answer it.
That's a tough one. We can provide them means and averages, but I don't think that we really have that much data sliced and diced that precisely to be able to predict that for patients.
What about identifying the longer term, these 20-25% of patients who make it to 5 years? Do we know who they are or what types of tumors they have?
I mean, my clinical suspicion is it's just the patient you described. It's the older patients with strongly ER-positive, PR-positive tumors, bone-only disease, soft tissue disease. I mean, we know that those are good prognostic factors for survival for patients with metastatic disease. Or additionally, patients with long disease-free intervals. So patients who have relapses 15 years or 20 years after their primary tend to have very indolent disease course.
What fraction of patients make it out to 5 years who have no evidence of disease or still in complete clinical remission or go into clinical remission and stay there for at least 5 years? You all have published on that, but that was more in the pre-adjuvant chemo era. Right now, what do we know about that?
I think the best data we have is still the older studies that we have from Anderson, and that it was only about 3% that were still out in complete remission. But the 3% tail continued out almost up to 20 years. So there really were these patients who had complete responses who hadn't recurred for very long periods of time. Unfortunately, it's a really tiny minority of patients.
I'm curious what your perspective is sort of globally on sort of the direction of clinical research in breast cancer. Where do you see things heading, and do you think we're heading in the right direction?
I think we are heading in the right direction. It's hard not to be encouraged with the changes over the past couple of years that we've seen with the new targeted agents that have come out. The ASCO, when all the trastuzumab data was presented, was really one of the most exciting experiences I've sat through or lived through. But I think that's generally the direction. I think most people are looking to try to subclassify breast cancer into more and more different types and then have appropriate therapies for each type of breast cancer rather than treating it globally just as one disease. That makes a lot of sense, especially given the heterogeneity of the survival experience that we were just discussing. We know there are patients who have really aggressive disease, and we know there are patients that have really indolent disease, and it clinically it doesn't feel like one disease. And I think biologically we're getting more information to back that up.
Getting back to this issue of metastatic disease and prognosis, I'm curious what your take is on the bevacizumab data that, as you mentioned, came out a couple of years ago with the Taxol ECOG study. How are you approaching management of metastatic disease and specifically chemotherapy and the issue of bevacizumab in a non-protocol setting right now?
I'm discussing it with patients up front in the first-line metastatic setting in combination with taxanes, but I really haven't been using it in second, third, fourth-line therapy. And it's hard to know, you know, so many of our patients now have received taxanes in the adjuvant setting, and I know that trial did include some patients who'd had adjuvant taxanes, but a lot of times the taxanes aren't necessarily my first choice in the upfront setting because so many of my patients have already received them.
And what do you do then?
I usually start with capecitabine because most of my patients have had anthracyclines and taxanes.
What about the issue of capecitabine and bevacizumab?
The data we have so far combining it really didn't show any improvement in survival. So for such an expensive medication, I haven't felt overly enthusiastic about using it in that setting. Although last time I looked at the NCI website for bevacizumab, there were like 40 active bevacizumab trials in breast cancer, so we're going to have a lot more information.
What's been your experience clinically with using bevacizumab in terms of hypertension and other problems? How easy or difficult has it been?
I've found patients tolerate it quite well. I mean, I have had a few patients with issues of hypertension, but I haven't seen it as a major problem in the management of those patients.
What about the patient with HER2-positive disease in the metastatic setting, both ER-positive and ER-negative? First, maybe we can start out with ER-positive. We had the TANDEM trial data that's been presented over the last year looking at combination of trastuzumab and hormonal therapy. I think it was an AI in that situation. How do you approach the ER-positive, HER2-positive patient in the metastatic setting?
I have to say I was a little disappointed in the results of that study because even though trastuzumab had a benefit with the aromatase inhibitors, response rates still were pretty low, especially in contrast to the 70% response rate we see with chemotherapy plus trastuzumab. So my inclination is usually to still go ahead and start with chemotherapy and trastuzumab. I've had so many patients with excellent responses and some with complete responses that are still doing well that I hesitate to start with the hormonal plus trastuzumab.
What about the patient who's not super sick, not, you know, visceral disease? Are there situations where you'll use hormonal therapy alone? Or because a lot of people are kind of concerned that in that study, endocrine therapy alone didn't look all that great. But is that a strategy you use in those patients?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, for patients with indolent disease, bone-only disease, older patients, even patients with low-volume visceral metastasis, yes, I definitely will start with hormonal therapy.
What about the choice of hormonal therapy in the metastatic setting, specifically in postmenopausal patients? We have more and more people now who are going to be relapsing and are relapsing after having received an aromatase inhibitor. How do you approach the decision about the next hormonal therapy in those patients?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, for my patients that have had adjuvant aromatase inhibitors, I typically would go back and start with tamoxifen rather than reintroduce a drug they've already had or even the same class of drug.
What do we know about responses to tamoxifen after AIs and how that might compare to, for example, fulvestrant or exemestane?
Not much, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't know anything. Because that's why people say that, and I'm like, well, what do we know about it? I guess it's interesting to think about what the impact would be of tamoxifen after an aromatase inhibitor, particularly if somebody actually relapses while they're on an aromatase inhibitor. You know, you have this whole thing of the cells being reconditioned or whatever, and I guess we'll see that in the big study because in the adjuvant setting, they're actually going to look at that. You know, I'm kind of curious whether you know anything about this because I've been asking people and nobody seems to have an answer. And that's the issue of using LHRH agonists in women with breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And specifically the issue of using monthly versus every 3 month formulations. How do you approach that question?
So if you're using every 3 month injections, we do know that there's patients that will break through on that. However, the convenience is so much greater for patients that if we're treating especially a patient with metastatic disease, I think it may be worthwhile. I mean, I think what I do is if I'm using it every 3 months, just continue to monitor their hormonal status to make sure that they really remain in biochemical menopause.
Are there situations where you'll use ovarian suppression in the adjuvant setting?
I personally have not been using that in the adjuvant setting, no, except we're participating in the SOFT trial, which is looking at the role of ovarian suppression either by itself or with an aromatase inhibitor for premenopausal patients. So if I have a patient I'm considering that, I would try to enroll them in the SOFT trial, but I don't use ovarian suppression off of study.
How do you approach the issue of initiating endocrine therapy in the adjuvant setting in the postmenopausal patient? You know, we obviously have all the trials coming out with aromatase inhibitors. There's still a little bit of controversy about what the optimal sequence is. What are your thoughts about that?
I mean, I start up front with an aromatase inhibitor. My own personal belief is the data we have shows it's a more effective medication. And while I recognize we really don't know if it could be possible, we really haven't compared directly starting with tamoxifen, switching to an AI versus starting with an AI. However, the data that we have show that AIs are better, and I have a concern about patients that would relapse in that time period when they're on tamoxifen that might not relapse if I'd started on an aromatase inhibitor. So my preference is to start with the aromatase inhibitor.
How do you approach the postmenopausal patient who's had tamoxifen in the past, who has had a full 5 years, and particularly those women who may have been off therapy for all a year, two, or even 3 or 4 years? How do you approach that decision about whether to start an AI?
If they've been off usually 6 months or a year, then I probably would start an AI for extended adjuvant therapy. I personally don't feel there's enough data starting 2, 3, 4 years after that I'm comfortable starting an AI, sort of the do no harm principle, because I know that there is toxicity associated with aromatase inhibitors, especially bone loss, and we don't have high quality evidence for that group of patients. Having said that, you wonder if there would be benefit. When we've looked previously at recurrent rates for ER-positive breast cancer, the hazard each year is flat out indefinitely. So, I mean, a patient at 10 years really still does have a significant risk.
The way you've approached the use of the SEER database and this whole research strategy is really interesting. Any sort of pet ideas you have that you'd like to try in the future utilizing that approach?
Generally, I'm very interested in both treatment patterns and patterns of care and using the database to try to explore toxicities that we can't capture on clinical trials. Because I think that's one of the really unique assets of it. Because you have tens of thousands of patients that are captured in this database. You have all of their medical claims that have been submitted. So you can really get information on toxicity for people treated in the real world setting. Up in the ivory tower when we treat everybody on clinical trials and the median age is always 55 and everybody's healthy and young, it's just not the same, I don't think, as real-world medicine treating patients in the community. So I'm very interested in using that data to try to get a sense of toxicities and the experience for women treated in the community, especially the impact of other illnesses and comorbid diseases on their treatment for cancer.
Any particular complications, long-term complications, that you kind of thought about you'd like to take a look at?
Currently, I've been looking at bisphosphonate use, so generally looking at rates of bisphosphonate use, who's receiving bisphosphonates, and potentially we're considering looking at some of the toxicities of bisphosphonate use. They're a little harder to tease out in the Medicare database because they don't have specific billing codes, but it would be another way to look at new toxicities such as osteonecrosis of the jaw.
What do we know right now about that?
I think overall it's a very low incidence, especially compared to the benefit that we're getting by using bisphosphonates in patients. But it's become a real concern of patients, too. I mean, I have a lot of patients who bring this up as a topic and are very concerned about using any kind of bisphosphonate because of concerns of osteonecrosis of the jaw. I think that using the big database to capture that kind of information would be really useful, though, because we don't have a way of tracking all our individual patients to follow this. A lot of patients come for treatment and go home to their general doctor afterwards and don't necessarily return to the oncology world.
What about CNS long-term issues? Particularly, you know, you hear about, quote, chemo brain and, you know, the issue about dementia. And any thoughts about looking into that, or do we know anything about that?
We've done some exploratory work looking at that. It's very hard to pick up using database stuff. Most of the cognitive dysfunction that we're seeing from chemotherapy are very subtle changes. So they're not changes you would just pick up in a routine patient physician visit. I don't think they're things a doctor would notice. They're things that are very important to the patient in terms of memory span or recall, attention span. But these are things that are really picked up on very careful neurocognitive testing, not so much on Medicare claims. So I don't think that Medicare research will be a very useful way to look at that.
Any thoughts you have yourself clinically in terms of what's going on there? I mean, do you think it's possible slash likely that the agents specifically are causing some type of cognitive problem? I mean, I think about all the changes that women go through emotionally and et cetera, and the stresses that they go through, and just the aging process in terms of, you know, having more things on your mind. I'm trying to justify why my memory's not good anymore.
Well, I mean, there's clearly a lot of factors that are going on right then. And so, I mean, you're looking at issues of, you know, enormous amounts of stress with a new diagnosis of cancer, possible cytokines released by the cancer that may cause cognitive changes even before treatment starts, the effects of chemotherapy, the effects of going into menopause, the effects of estrogen blockade. So there's so many different things in there. It's very hard to tease out the contribution of each one. Having said that, I know, I mean, for some patients, it clearly is a real phenomenon. One of my very young patients in her 30s got chemotherapy, and she runs a daycare center. And she said, you know, I can't come up with people's names. She's like, I always was great with names. I could get everybody. Now she's like, I just can't pull them out. And then I saw her actually about a year follow-up visit, and that's starting to get better and get back to normal. So I think there really are changes, but it's only some patients that are really affected strongly by it.